Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Welcome back to the House of Demi, the latest entry in the House Light series here on the Nerd Party Network. We finished The Wing of Hannibal, and we're returning to cover the rest of Demi's directorial work of the 1990s with 1993's Philadelphia. I'm Darren Moser, and I'm joined again by my friends, Court Counselor Tristan Riddell and Iron Jaw Judge John Mills. Gentlemen, it's time for a new case in Philadelphia. So what did you guys think this movie was going to be based on the cover? Because I was thinking like The Firm and like these intense like legal dramas, and it obviously there's court stuff, but it was definitely a heartstrings movie.
So wait, this is your first time seeing it?
This was my first time seeing it, yes.
Okay. See, I saw this in the movie theater back in the day. So like for me, I knew what to expect going into it. And so it was... It was my first time revisiting it in some time, but I can simply give you the perspective of somebody who saw it back in the day. There was no question what the movie was about.
Okay.
And
everybody knew the
marketing campaign back then was like, this is what the movie's about. Go see this movie because you should see this movie. And I was like, okay, we'll go see this movie sort of thing. So, you know, and it got heaped with a ton of praise. And Bruce Springsteen's song played endlessly on the radio, too, which was nice. Mm-hmm. Non-stop.
This is the second time I've seen it. And the first time I saw it was eons ago. I think it was in the 90s on TV. And I think I was watching it with my parents. And so it was super long time ago. So I remembered a shocking amount for it being so long ago. But even I was surprised at how few courtroom scenes there were. Even though I'd seen it before, I'm like, I thought this was more of a courtroom drama.
Well, I can also tell you that the unfortunate thing is, I don't know if anybody remembers the animated series, The Critic, starring John Lovitz. They would do their parody movies and stuff like that. And every time I think of Philadelphia and that one courtroom scene where the camera starts tilting, like in the funny angles and everything, I remember him on the show saying, Jerry Lewis wants to get in on the dramatic action with his own courtroom drama, Schenectady. And it's it's that moment where the camera's going and it's just, you know, they've got Jerry Lewis doing like, nice lady, asking the question. And it's so I can't look at this movie without thinking of the critics thing. Yeah.
Well, also in all of the courtroom scenes, I guess they're going for realism, but I don't think I've ever seen a film where the counsel doesn't ever seem to get up from their chairs. It was really, I'm so used to courtroom dramas where, okay, it's question time. You get up and you walk over. And I mean, not that they didn't do that a couple of times, but it was very made clear that like, why aren't you in your seat? I'm like, oh, that's kind of boring. Like maybe I'm sure that's probably the way it's supposed to be done, but it felt odd.
In real life, most of the time I've seen where there's a podium that the lawyers go to. They either sit or they go to the podium and that's it. Like there's no Southern, you know, monkey trial.
I may be a simple country lawyer.
Where they walk around. Yeah.
Well, and actually just going down that rabbit hole, something that changed things where lawyers would start up and, you know, approaching and going to the podium and stuff like that. The story I was always told from my friend who did go to law school was that it was, what was the show with Perry Mason?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. And the thing is, they had to have him get up and walk to the jury because of the TV camera and the amount of screen space that they had. So that was the only way they could show him and the jury in the same thing. And
but that's not how it's done at all. Yeah.
Right. But it did in fact temper jury expectations for lawyer behavior. And so they sort of adapted much the same way that in the 90s or early 2000s, whatever, CSI.
I warped, was just about to say that.
The CSI effect.
Warped jury perceptions about like how fast DNA testing goes. Where you know, it's not 2 seconds. You know,
how you can find a fingerprint. Like you can't just search the database.
Exactly. Yeah, how much in actual trials it's like
just a hair over circumstantial. Like, it's really not the ironclad case that we had every week at CSI.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. So no, but it was enough for me to notice. Like, it felt different because, again, probably they're going for more realism. I believe they actually shot in a actual courtroom for this, you know, the nice rich mahogany rails.
This was a legit courtroom. Yeah, it wasn't a set. And so I wonder if, because they used a real courtroom, if they probably asked how things went down in said courtroom. Like, what's the policy here? Like, what's this is, of course, just conjecture on my part.
And you know that it led to one of the things that actually got under my skin at one point in the movie is the
Objection, recording. Conjecture by Mr. Riddell.
At one point, it jumped out at me. At this point, Denzel Washington walks up to approach the bench because the judge is, you know, asking for an explanation or whatever.
He's still a mile away. But
you hear the footsteps. And I look down and I go, that's carpet. And then every time I heard footsteps in the courtroom, I was like, that's not what those footsteps would be. That shouldn't be. And it got under my skin. I can't help it. It's a sickness.
You just ruined that moment for me.
Sorry. My bad.
Well, every time we saw the head of the firm in some sort of meeting scene, I know it's completely different characters, but I kept flashing back to the beginning of Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, where he's just kind of sitting there looking at things. It's all could have been a meeting on Monday, but no. Again, I know, totally different law firm versus advertising agency. But
since we're on the subject of expectations of the movie and moments that were ruined for us or something like that, and John, I sent you this clip last night. Here's the thing: it's just like, we know how serious this subject matter is. We are completely aware. And as you can tell, we're trying to avoid getting to that point, just because we know once we get there, there's no turning back. But Family Guy has ruined so many moments for me in film and TV, and powerful moments too, where there's a scene where Brian, the dog, and Stewie are DJs. They're shock jocks. And they just keep like playing sound effects over again and over again, just like, wowie, like, don't you do it. Like, food fight, you know, everything like that. And they're like, make sure to tune in next, because this is coming up. And then Stewie hits a button, and then you hear Denzel Washington say, they found out he was gay, they found out he had AIDS, and they fired him because of it. And like, you had this really powerful moment from Denzel, and then Brian's like, what is wrong with you? He's like, oh, I'm so sorry, that was supposed to be Food Fight from Animal House.
Family Guy. There are a lot of things they've done that to,
so many things.
So, but you know what, Darren, you're the only one that's seen this for the first time.
This was for the first time.
So what were you expecting? So this defies expectations somewhat?
A little bit. I mean, between the span of expectations of looking up, you know, the film for a moment before watching it, you know, I purposely don't try to read into, you know, I don't open the IMDb article or anything like that. But again, the poster, it's a courtroom drama. It's got that black and white. Like, yeah, I thought there'd be a lot more courtroom. I had no idea they were going to be talking about, you know, homosexuality or AIDS or all the characters that I would know that end up in this movie, a lot of actors and actresses. It was interesting to see, and just, again, not knowing in the beginning, as we're starting with Andy, with Tom Hanks's character, and we're just, it's like, oh no, where's the file? And I'm like, oh my gosh, what is, like, that's the crux of it. And then it ends up being like, that barely has a blip on the radar of the plot of this movie. But I still want to know what happened to that file. I saw him put it on his desk, so something must have happened.
What do you mean it wasn't it's a major plot point?
No, it is a plot point, but I'm saying, like, in the beginning, I feel like that's the plot. The plot is about this firm and their actions, and then it turns the page and becomes about the firing. Like, yeah, obviously okay, it is okay. part of the plot point. I just, that's like the pre-inciting incident, you know, moment. And then we switch to the, for the bulk of the movie is actually about this wrongful termination lawsuit.
I was thinking it
was building on that. But no, I think it did, you know, a great job establishing Andy. It's also, I mean, it's 93 and I was very young in 93. So I definitely did not watch this in first run in the theaters, but I tried to put myself back into those days and just the kind of movies that were out, the kind of stories people were trying to tell. And this movie obviously is trying to, which I think I'd read that Demi wanted to tell this after a friend of his that he knew had been diagnosed with AIDS. And it's, I've heard it being touted as, you know, one of the films that really re-educated the populace about AIDS and not just what we all thought we knew. But it's hard because I wasn't really in that conversation at that age.
See, since I was old enough back then, you know, everybody's perception of the time is going to be shaded by where they were, you know, what type of environment they were in, where they were, that sort of thing. So like even my experience at the time isn't going to be necessarily what somebody else's experience in another place would have been. But I know that AIDS awareness was not an issue per se for, you know, my cohort of friends and acquaintances. Everybody was, you know, aware of it. And wasn't, you know, it wasn't something that was as, you know, mysterious a thing, I guess, by that, because, you know, they'd had, different, you know, charity events and stuff like that. You know, of course stuff fades in time. Cause like, was it before or after Philadelphia or contemporaneous with sort of thing. But I mean, you know, you've also got to keep in mind, I have my mother and large number of aunts and cousins were also nurses and, you know, in hospitals and medical field and stuff like that. So, you know, my perception of things is undoubtedly, you know, shifted a little bit by that as well. But, you know, this is an important film in the fact that it's the first one to really broach this topic in a mainstream audience sort of way. But I would say that the audience was very much prepared for it, very much knew about it. Like all of the AIDS education stuff had started happening before this movie landed. You know,
yeah, the 90s was very different from the 80s in terms of AIDS awareness and education.
And that's one of the things that's interesting too, because going back and revisiting this, I think that it's one of those things where this is 93, and I don't know the specific development history of the script, but there are certain points where they say, oh, am I going to get it by touching something? Am I going to get it from a toilet seat? But by 93, we all had enough of a knowledge base to know, you know, I remember back in the 80s when people started talking about it, people started freaking out about water fountains and stuff like that. There was all sorts of stuff floating out there about, oh, you could get it from touching a sweaty seat or something like that. But by 93, again, there had been enough awareness, at least in my part of the world, you know, in terms of what it meant. And so it's, it would almost be an interesting sort of mental exercise to say, should this movie have been taken out of a major metropolitan area like Philadelphia and put in a different location so that that unawareness would have been a little bit more believable to the audience coming into it?
That's interesting that you say that, because you were born and raised in the DC area.
Yeah.
And I mean, you know, that's the hub of political culture and awareness and,
sadly,
you know, legislation and defamation lawsuits and everything like that. You know, like that's a world point. And, you know, I'm from the Midwest, where I was born and raised 2.5 hours, 3 hours from a major city in either direction. And I remember being in elementary school in the early 90s and seeing posters up about how you
how you don't contract AIDS.
Right.
So I remember seeing those posters, and this would have been around 93, you know, like seeing those posters. So I feel like even if in your circle and in your part of the world where that was, you know, it was clearly, you know, you were clearly educated on the matter, I think you're right, because I don't think your experience was universal. And I know you're not saying that, you're saying the opposite. But I do not think your experience is universal, because as someone from the Midwest, you know, not a part of a major city, there were still ad campaigns and posters to raise awareness that, you know, you can be around HIV positive people and not contract anything by just being around them, shaking hands, hugging, you know, and everything like that. I think that would be interesting, because this movie was clearly written in a time, because this is based off of a court case that happened in 86. Mm-hmm. And 86 was okay. A vastly different world than it was when it was released in 93. And this movie had a real hard time getting made. Like, it was like the company who was making it almost filed for bankruptcy. The script went through 25 revision changes. There was major revisions, like not just like tweaks, like major revisions, and like trying to find actors, trying to get rights to the script. So this process had to have happened several years before 93. So, you know, like my guess is this started in the 80s, the process of making this film, and it didn't get made and released until 93.
Now, and also just to toss on to that, Scott Rudin was apparently entangled in an issue because he, in 1987, he spoke to the family and their lawyers about using, who was it? It was Bowers.
Yeah, the Bowers.
Jeffrey Bowers' family, he approached them and talked about using his story as the basis for a film. And then the film gets made, and then the Bowers family later sued, saying this is what it says here, that they asserted that 54 scenes in the movie were so similar to his life that they could have only come from the interviews. And so there was a lawsuit about all of this. So, you know, I'm sure that didn't, you know, those sorts of things didn't help too much on the legal front.
Absolutely.
Well, and I was also just looking up when Princess Diana had that moment where she shook hands with an AIDS patient, and that was 87. Sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah, 87. So yeah, just that era of time. So you bring in Tom Hanks, you know, this who would go on to win, you know, his first Oscar for Best Actor, and then win it again the following year for Forrest Gump. You have Denzel Washington, which I believe this was his last picture where he was not the lead, like the number one guy. That's what I've heard said. So he's up and coming.
And well, I think that this is one of those things, and it very much cemented it on this viewing, where Denzel Washington, and I'm not alone in this opinion, not at least getting a nomination for Best Supporting Actor is a massive wrong oversight sort of thing from the Academy, because Hanks is terrific. Hanks is great. And Hanks, I think, is aided back then by the fact that everybody thought Tom Hanks, funny guy. Right. And then he did this role.
It's
and
already like, oh, so jarring right. doing right. this kind of a role.
In a sense, it's sort of like Bryan Cranston crossing over and becoming,
going from Malcolm in the Middle to Breaking Bad.
Going into Breaking Bad, right. It's a huge thing. And there's so much goodwill that the audience brings in from this positive relationship that you're instantly disarmed from the dramatic turn. But I do think Hanks does a terrific performance here, but it really is a case of those performances don't occur in a vacuum. And I think Denzel Washington, and even just what he does with his character and the journey his character goes on, is so wonderful. There's so much growth and so much range in the character, and he actually goes from, you know, point A to point B in a very you know, massive fashion. And it, so I just always have always felt that Denzel Washington deserved more credit for what this movie became.
I want to talk about that. Like, since you're bringing up Denzel's performance,
yeah.
Before we even talk about Hanks, let's talk about Denzel's performance, because you talked about the arc of his character. And even though this was a 2-hour movie, you know, it spanned many months. Like, I was actually, I was surprised
lots of
at how
time jumps.
A lot of the time jumps, I was like, oh, you know, like 1 week goes by, like 6 months goes. I was like, oh, damn, okay. I want to talk about how well Washington's performance was written and how well he portrayed it, because the language that was used and the bigotry is unflinching and it's very casual, and it needed to be that way, because even though we just got done talking about how AIDS awareness was different in the 80s than it was in the 90s, that doesn't mean the stigma was any better in the 90s than it was in the 80s. And Denzel's character is the embodiment of that. And we see that progression. We see his anger. We see his disgust. We see his anger. And like he tries to meet in the middle, but he tries to get a little bit toward closer to the center by saying, I was like, oh, well, you know, like they disgust me, but they still have the rights as everyone else, and the law was broken. And then it goes a little bit further and a little bit further, and he gets to know, you know, Andrew more and more. And, you know, like we don't have this huge expositional moment with Denzel at the end. It's not him saying like, you've changed me, you know, like I'm going to lead my life differently, right. You know, like I'm no longer a bigot and everything like that. He just has that singular moment when he helps him put on his oxygen mask. Yeah. And
the acceptance of the family, I'd say.
And the acceptance of the family. It's just like, and that's all that was needed. Like, you see this person who, you know, like went to the doctor because he shook hands with an HIV
positive
person.
Or just the
first
scene. I think of that first scene where he shakes his hand and then backs away. Once he's like,
backs
into the corner versus, like you said, the last time he sees him adjusting the mask. That is the arc.
That's the arc. And and even like, I loved the moment. It was such a subtle moment. Well, maybe not so subtle, but Denzel is in the library and he's sitting down and he's researching. And then
he's trying to hide behind the books.
That's not even the moment I'm talking about. Like the white security guard walks by him and just stares at him. And every black person can tell you that they've had a similar experience many times. And I think that
you don't belong here stare.
Right. And then he sees that happen outwardly and vocally to Hanks. And he starts thinking about his own, you know, the prejudice that he feels against him. And then thinks about the prejudice that Hanks's character is going through. And I think that was the turn. That was the click that he needed to go and talk to him more. And I really, really like that scene, because so much happens in that one scene, and it's so pivotal, but it's not in your face.
Yes.
Well, as much as an in your face Demi movie where the camera is literally in their faces.
Oh my God.
All the time.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. I'm glad you bring that up, both of you, because there's a question I have as I'm watching this. Do you think that Demi's style here, which works so well with Silence of the Lambs in terms of establishing a connection with people and disarming the audience and putting them on edge, do those camera moves and shot selections work here? Do you think they work to the advantage of the story in terms of conveying all of the different, you know, emotional states of the characters and all of that? Or do you think that this is something where it doesn't translate as well?
I'm going to hit it hard and say Demi shouldn't have directed this film. This should have been a different director. If it was a different director, it would have gotten Best Picture. And I think he became overindulgent. I feel like he kind of had the John Woo effect, where
it's so hard to watch later John Woo films because he becomes so self-referential. He's aware of his own trademarks that it's like he has a checklist on his to-do list.
Like if he doesn't adhere to the checklist, then it's not his own movie, but it's making the movie. He can do whatever he wants.
And with Demi, he smacked us in the face so early on and so much that it was exhausting to see that kind of camera work where it was, there was even times like during the promotion scene where we have this upwards angle on the lead partner, on the senior partner. And he's like looming over the camera and it was completely inappropriate to the time. Like I know that, you know, oftentimes when the camera is low and looking up, it shows the power of a character and how they dominate the scene, but it was not the emotional resonance that was needed for that particular scene. I could definitely see it later on, but like there were so many times for the first act of the film, I think the first act where it just, the camera language mismatched what the tone was going for. And so by the time we actually get to the emotional moments where it's like Denzel and Hanks at the end of the library where they're looking at each other and you can tell Denzel's interested in taking the case, or when it's Hanks and Banderas in the hospital and they're looking at each other and it's, you know, they're looking at the camera, like those moments are perfect for it, but he didn't earn those moments because he didn't wait for him. And so I can't blame the cinematographer because it's all that's Demi's thumbprint all over it. And so I think he was the wrong director for this picture. The 26 minute mark, I'm saying that.
I don't disagree. I agree with everything that you're saying. And there's nothing I could really add to it. I agree with that. The only thing to pile on would be I did not care for at the time that I saw it back in 93. I didn't care for it now, and I don't know whether I watched it in between. Maybe I did, maybe I didn't, but like I had perfect recollection of the movie.
Just look on Letterboxd. I'm sure you logged it back in 96, right?
If only you know what? That's why I have to get the pro plan, is they give you a time travel.
That'd be amazing. Oh,
right, yeah, there you go.
Wouldn't that be great?
Can you import my note, my three ring binder?
Plug into your brain and it just pulls it all out.
But then it winds up like Free Jack. Look that one up, kids. That's a terrible movie from around the same time. And so, basically, I dislike the fact that it starts and ends with two music videos. I found that to be unnerving.
Thank you so much for bringing that up.
Okay, I will say I was feeling kind of nostalgic for the first music video. Yes, it was a music video, but the fact that it's just these everyday shots of like the early 90s, I'm like, oh man, yeah, you know, early 90s, like when, you know, and I totally recognize that a lot of that is because I was young in the early 90s and didn't have a bigger picture of the world, but you know, that's what nostalgia is all about. And you're like, oh, when life was simple and a little less complex.
I watched this with my wife and this was her first time seeing it. When the first music video finished, she turns to me and says, where does this take place again?
Okay. I want to talk about that. And like, yeah. and feel free to cut me off or
do you think they play it for the Chamber of Commerce, like on ads for coming to the city of Philadelphia?
Honestly, yeah, they should. But that's the thing is that's another thing that felt unearned. What was so Philadelphia about this movie?
Nothing.
The title.
Exactly.
I mean, it's just the title.
You have that opening music video and then the title. And then that's it. That's the only thing that was Philadelphia. You know, it had nothing, like, at least with like the movie Chicago, you could be a celebrity by doing horrible things and people would still love you. I know that's not unique to Chicago, but it was Chicago of that time. And so, and you even have a character saying that's Chicago, you know, that's Richard Gere saying that's Chicago. I don't know why I did it like in a pseudo Sean Connery, like that's the Chicago way, you know, different movie. But you know what I'm saying? And with Philadelphia, there was no like Denzel didn't even have like this little throwaway line where like, I've lived here all my life and thought this, blah, blah, blah. Or like, They're like, you know, like did this, did that. You know, I don't know. Maybe I'm going off the rails here.
No. The one wedge that they have is that it gives Denzel the ability to give that speech coming out of the courtroom saying the birthplace of freedom and the Constitution.
This city of brotherly
love.
Why,
yeah, this city, this is why it deserves this. And it's like, okay, you have that one moment. Mm-hmm. But to your point, there is nothing about this film where I look at it and say, I feel like the town had anything really to do with it, or that I feel like I know the city any better or its history.
Yeah.
There's nothing about it.
Speaking of Chicago, again, I know I'm partial to it for obvious reasons, but watch While You Were Sleeping. That could have been named Chicago.
I feel more connected to Baltimore from Hairspray than I do to Philadelphia from this movie.
Being connected to Baltimore is not a good thing. I will send you the card for a good therapist.
I remember the first time I went to Baltimore, I'm like, this is what everyone's talking about.
Yeah. Actually, while you're talking about the opening music video, it closes with the second music video with the song that was also nominated for Best Original Song in a Motion Picture from Neil Young. And I'll never forget two things about Hanks's acceptance speech, because I'm sitting there watching it. I still watched the Oscars back then with my friends, was still fancying I might become an actor and all of those sorts of things. So we're watching the Oscars and Hanks gives his acceptance speech, and he actually called out that Neil Young's song was better and more appropriate and more evocative of the movie than Bruce Springsteen's. And Springsteen had already won the Best Song Oscar. And I was like, wow, bro, that's uncool. And then, of course, because it became the basis of the movie In and Out, I still remember when Hanks was giving his acceptance speech and he called out his old drama teacher and he's like, and he's gay. And the whole reason we saw In and Out was we all had that same reaction where he sat there, he goes, and he's gay. And we all sat there and said, boy, I sure hope he cleared that with that guy before he said anything.
Yeah.
He is now, which of course he was, and Hanks had asked and all of that sort of thing. But and even now, watching it now, like, it really did not work for me that it opened and closed the way that it did. It just didn't.
I think that's part of the reason why I feel like Demme was the wrong director. Like, it just, you saw his stamp. Like, those are director decisions. You know, like having those intro, the outro, the title font, the camera movements. But you have the script and the performances. Like, granted, you have to be a great director to get those kind of performances, and you have to collaborate with a writer and get that script. I'm not trying to say that Demme's a bad director. It's just his style was just, you could just really see it hit hard and clash hard at those specific moments.
Yeah.
Well, talking about some of the other actors, so that was one of the fun things of this. I always enjoy watching older movies. Now that I've seen many more things in my life, I've seen more television, I've seen more films. And so seeing other actors pop up, you know, and not by any means the big actors of this film, which obviously are, you know, Denzel and Hanks, but I loved, you know, when Back to the Future 3, Clara shows up as a lawyer and is like grilling him with the mirror. And I'm like, oh, this is like, you look pretty much just like your scene in Back to the Future. So she has such a unique voice.
Like Mary, is it?
Yeah.
Steenburgen. Yeah. I always get that wrong. Steenburgen. She has such a unique voice. And it's such a soft voice too. Like it's such a very feminine and airy and just pleasant voice. And then when you see her be this lawyer who's just like raking him over the coals and just like,
who's obviously the first seat lawyer. Like, she's the one asking all the questions. Yeah.
Like, this is a very competent, very, very, you know, like,
then they get out the lawyer. Charcuterie board, which turns out to be a mirror and not a charcuterie board, which I totally thought it was in the first shot. And,
it's very much like it's very staggering to see that, because like of the roles that we've seen her in, and like, she just has such a pleasant disposition.
Yeah.
And I love that she has that moment where she turns and she says, I hate this case. Apparently, like, that was ad-libbed by her because she made some comment to Demi about how, like, disgusting her character was and how horrible this case was. And he said, he's like, you should, like, let's make her more human then. Like, this is a job for her. Let's give some moment of vulnerability. I thought that was a nice touch.
Yeah, and it's, and that's the thing, is if you're a lawyer and you're contract, like, lawyers are, especially defense lawyers, it's a job. You don't have even to like Denzel, who you're defending.
Mass majority of this movie is like, I don't like my client or his lifestyle or any of that, but the law is the law. You know, they repeat that mantra over and over.
Well, one thing that I liked, not one thing that I think worked in one regard but didn't work in another, is there was one jury member that they focused on, and I will always think of him as Mr. Krueger from Seinfeld, because that's what he later went on to play. But the camera would fixate on him during certain things about, you know, being in the Navy and gay guys in the Navy and stuff like that. And it very much was building along this thing of like, oh, this guy's going to be the a-hole that ruins everything for everyone. And then it goes to the jury room and he just says, oh no. And when I was in the Navy, I'd send my top pilot. This is proof that they trusted and loved it. And it in one sense, I think communicates that the case was so strong and correct that even this guy that was prejudiced, maybe going in, it turned, but we didn't get that turn. We didn't get a moment where we had a reaction in the jury box where suddenly you see him think as if to say, hey, wait a minute. It's all, he looks like a jackass. And then they cut to him in the jury room and he's like, well, I think Andy should win.
With a heart of gold.
Right. And it's like that felt a little unearned.
I don't know. I hear what you're saying, but it worked for me because I'm not going to try to rewrite the film, but I'm not sure where that would go in, you know, where we'd see that turn or how we would get that information, because I really think it was just this guy throws down logic, like regardless of opinion, regardless of what you think of Andrew's sexuality or a situation, whether you have a stigma towards AIDS or not, he broke down the entire defense in 10 seconds.
Yeah.
And I think it was hilarious to me, but it was also heartwarming at the same time, where you just like, this is what a jury should do, regardless of your opinion, regardless of your bias. Like he's trying to
represent people. This is how people society should act. Yeah.
Right. And that's why I'm saying I'm of two minds of it. I think just a visual reaction shot of somebody from the defense side saying something or giving a smirk and just seeing him sort of like narrow his eyes like
wait a minute. Yeah.
I can see that. Okay.
That sort of thing.
Yeah. I get that.
I would also say that there are too many, and I know this is, I guess, unavoidable, but there are too many people on the defense side.
A lot of people on defense.
Right. And obviously there are a lot of partners, they're all there, but there is a sense of it dilutes the characters. They're exactly where their motivations are.
Which old white man is this? No, that's that old white man that's sitting there.
But even beyond that, it's like who did have this specific problem? So can't even seem to agree among themselves as to who has the big problem, sort of thing. And I guess that makes its own statement. But I would have probably cut down the number of partners by one or two.
Okay, so you weren't talking about the lawyers trying the case. You were talking about the partners being present.
Yeah. The partners, I would have whittled them down.
Yeah, I think that's smart because you give the audience much more of a focus and embodiment of what is wrong with that law firm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not that you can't call other people up to the stand, but like sitting at the bench, sitting on the side. Yeah. Well, we also get 13th Warrior returning to the House Lights. Mr. Antonio Banderas in a smaller, little bit smaller role. But
well, this was his big American cinema break, wasn't it? Because this is the first time I ever saw him in a film. Was
looking at his IMDb, anything before this, I didn't recognize. And he did Mariachi like 3 years after this, I think. Not too long after.
So. Yeah, Mariachi after, wait. No, you mean Desperado?
I mean Desperado, but I mean yeah, I the first, say, I of, say, yeah. first of those movies, yeah.
Okay, all right. Desperado was the first one? Why did I think that was the second one? I thought El Mariachi was the... Doesn't matter.
El Mariachi is the first one. Desperado's right. basically a remake, but yeah. technically the second one.
Right.
And then you have Once Upon a Time in Mexico, which is completely underrated.
Also a really fun character, I mean, very, very tiny role. One of the brothers, Matt Beckett, is our good friend Jammer from The Abyss. Did I put a wall here?
Right when he popped up, I screamed Jammer.
I saw him and I'm like, wait, and it took me half a second to click the face, but I was like, that guy looks so familiar. And then he started talking. I'm like, oh, it's Jammer. And I have like never seen that actor in any other role. So it was so fun to see him.
So yes, Banderas showed up in Mambo Kings in 92. Apparently, he had to learn all of his lines phonetically because he still wasn't fluent in English.
Oh, wow.
So yes, Philadelphia was his big mainstream breakthrough. I remember ads for the Mambo Kings. I remember that I was not unique in never seeing the Mambo Kings. But yes, Philadelphia would have been the one where he suddenly broke through.
Oh, damn. And he played Armand in Interview mm-hmm. with a Vampire just the next year.
Yeah, he started rocking real fast.
And then Desperado in 95, Four Rooms in 95, Assassins in 95,
mm-hmm.
Evita in 96. Oh, yeah.
And then Zorro.
Damn. And then not to forget the 13th Warrior in
1999. Oh, yeah, it's true. Not to forget.
No, this was clearly the beginning of his... of his U.S. success. Man, I love 90s.
Well, and we have two Silence of the Lambs alums. Because remember, we're back in the House of Demi, even though we took a mm-hmm. sidestep into the wing. So you have the actor who played Lieutenant Boyle, who was the judge. Judge Lucas Garnett, good old Iron Jaw. So not a huge role in Silence of the Lambs, but...
Mm-hmm. There's more than two, though, here.
Oh, well, the other one I had listed was the one who played Krenler. Paul Krenler was Ron Walter, who also apparently is an HIV positive actor who the producers didn't want to put in this movie because of that. And when it was pointed at the hypocrisy, it kind of, well, I guess,
was it a through. Was it an insurance thing? Because yeah, sometimes insurance agents on movies can be real. And, real jerks about stuff.
And to give credit where credit is due, Demi was the one who said, this is insanely
hypocritical. The person you said shouldn't direct this movie was the one who went for bat. Just
there
saying.
You go. But Tracy Walter, who was also in Silence of the Lambs, he's the librarian. Roger Corman was also in Silence of the Lambs, and he's here, and he's actually on the stand. So, and there was a doctor. The doctor... when he rushes off to the hospital and Antonio Banderas comes in and the doctor who's like, I could have you thrown out of here.
Oh,
He's one of the science nerds that
Clarice
goes to.
One of the bug guys.
Oh, yeah. Yep. You're right. Okay. Yep. So, I mean, again, we act like we're surprised, but this happens all the time with directors who bring on people from previous works and we just have to put ourselves back in that mindset.
And Denzel's daughter was named Clarice. So,
Right. I didn't even catch that.
I thought he said Louise when I was watching the movie, but it was actually Clarice.
I also noticed Chandra Wilson, who is Bailey from Grey's Anatomy. If you ever watch Grey's Anatomy, she's like the head of the OR. She's been on that show for like, I think she's still one of the main characters who's been there like the entire time, but I noticed her again, much younger, and she's got that. I think we mostly saw her in the hospitals, but yeah, no, it was a fun search into IMDb on all of these characters. Like, I know I've seen them somewhere. Where are they?
You know, we should, before we go any further, I think we should talk about Hanks's performance.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Let's do that. He had one.
It won him an Oscar. So
now, that was, Darren, this is your first time watching it.
Yes.
Do you think he deserved the Oscar? Do you think this was anything special? Do you think this was, you know, just an okay performance? Do you think anybody else could have done it? Or was it uniquely Hanks? How do you feel?
It's hard to say, because I feel like, well, I do feel it was a good performance. I feel like this is the kind of role that is encapsulated in the moment in which this movie is made. That is obviously a factor that cannot be ignored, and who Hanks is, where he is in his career. I mean, if you tried to make this movie after Forrest Gump and he had won an Oscar for Forrest Gump, he's not this, not that he was a no name, but like this, he had the right balance of knownness and, but also that goodwill we were talking about, that people were going to just see this. They're going to come and get their seats, their butts in the seats for Denzel and Hanks. And then they're going to get this amazing story, but that's what's going to draw them in. And yeah, I don't know if that would have worked not in 93, like later in his career. But no, I like the performance. It, you know, it is his movie, but in a way it's almost Denzel's. Like, we see way more of Denzel in the story, in the arc, in he's a lot, in a lot of ways, what's happening in the story is happening to Andy. He's not really having a lot of control over his own fate, except for the lawsuit.
Yeah, he's not really an active participant. Like, once he gets Denzel,
he's the inciting incident, but he's not really the protagonist.
Yeah, like once Denzel joins the team and takes the case, it becomes Denzel's movie. And I think it begins and ends with Andy, but then in the middle we have Denzel.
Yeah, I agree with that.
And I think that the time leaps don't help too much. I that is something that I don't like about what the script does. It's necessary in a large sense, because you have to advance him through the disease to get to the end that it's going to have. And so I get that. I understand. I think it could have been smoother. I think that there were certain things that, even at the time, I think Hanks gives a fine performance. The metric, and I think, Tristan, you said this in passing, the metric always in the brain is, what about this performance could not be replicated by anybody else? What makes this the most special performance? And I don't know that I see something like that here, especially in a year where I think Liam Neeson gave an incredible performance in Schindler's List. I really do. And of course, he was assisted by Ralph Fiennes. I did see in The Name of the Father, Daniel Day-Lewis is fine in that, but it wasn't anything where I was like, oh, wow, he's fantastic, right?
Demme actually wanted Daniel Day-Lewis for this role.
And that would have been interesting to see.
You know, Daniel Day-Lewis is good in almost everything, but at the same time, I don't know. I feel like Daniel Day-Lewis would have been a little bit bigger, maybe too big for the movie. And I'm not talking about star power. I'm talking about performance. Like, that was one really cool thing about Hanks's performance, was the subtlety that he brought to it. And I think Daniel Day-Lewis would have gone too hard. And the second choice was Michael Keaton. And I can really, really see Keaton in this role.
I can see Keaton in this role too, for sure.
Which is funny, because he turned this down to do My Life with Nicole Kidman, and where he plays a dying man.
Yes.
Which is interesting.
Have you guys ever seen that one?
I have. No, I like it. I own it.
Yeah. I like that. I actually got to see a press screener on that one. Well, that was cool. Back when I was working at a local newspaper. So
yeah, if you guys haven't seen it, you should check it out. Like, the premise is really interesting. Like, he contracts cancer, his wife is pregnant, so he records himself on videotape doing as many things as he can to instruct his future son on how to be a good person. Yeah. It's
a tearjerker. Yeah. It's a tearjerker.
But it's really well done.
Well, I feel Hanks was, like you said, the right blend for this, because he also kind of presented, like, I think the biggest comparison is, like you said, with Daniel Day-Lewis. With Hanks' portrayal, It's like he was playing it as just another person. Like, there's nothing overtly special about Andy. He's a lawyer. He has, you know, he loves people. He has a family, all of these things. Whereas I feel like if Daniel Day-Lewis was playing this, like you were saying, now I'm watching Daniel Day-Lewis be this character, you know, like
right.
Hank's faded into the role enough that I'm just watching this role. And, you know, and he goes through, you know, losing pounds of weight, and, you know, he very, very similar, kind of like The Martian, you know, where you're going through a body transformation.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely not what he did for Castaway, but he is committed to it. And the thing is, it feels like such a jackass thing to sit there and sort of nitpick Hanks's performance, because it is good. I think that actually what works against him is, again, just the structure of the script, and certain directorial choices undercut him. And maybe it's to the credit of the Academy that they can see past that in a way that I can't. Because again, I go back to, I remember seeing Philadelphia, I remember seeing Schindler's List, and I remember, in a sense, thinking that Liam Neeson, like, I think of Schindler's List and I think of that as like one of Liam Neeson's finest hours. And I can't picture anybody else there in that role. Yeah. And I don't, like, it's impossible for me to see anybody else in that role.
And it's so also telling that, you know, Hanks was nominated and won in a role in a movie that wasn't nominated for Best Picture.
Yes.
You know, that doesn't always happen.
That doesn't happen that often. And then won the following year for the win that, you know, swept everything.
Although arguably he should have been nominated. He was nominated. I think he should have won for Castaway. He would have been the first actor in decades to have done a three-peat.
I remember watching the Oscars before Castaway was made. It was like during his time off in between, like in the middle of the movie. And I remember my mom going like, "What the hell happened to Tom?"
Yeah.
Because he had the beard and it was like he had a hair tie around it and he was super skinny. And everybody's just like, "What is going?" Like, I think somebody in the house said, like, "It has to be for a role. Please let it be for a role."
Yeah, Tom Hanks did not fall off the wagon in a bad way. Well, I mean, this movie, we were looking it up, you know, budget of $26 million, made $206 million in 93 money, which is like $422 million in today's money. That's like, damn.
I'd argue it's even more than that in today's money, but, you know.
Oh, no, I used the calculator and for that conversion, but yeah.
Now, just imagine if it was released in 3D.
Well, ticket prices... Trust me, ticket prices back then, you young whippersnappers, way different than ticket prices now. Like,
that is true.
I would want to do number of tickets sold. What's impressive is this is not the type, like, Titanic becomes a thing where people see it multiple times. It runs forever. Philadelphia is not one that people walked out and they're like, let's buy a ticket and go back in. You know,
yeah, when it came out, it's not that sort of thing. Christmas time of 93, like, this was a Christmas January release. So maybe the lull of like other movies being out during that time. I don't know.
Well, I mean, Christmas used to be the domain of, that was where you dropped your serious Oscar contender stuff. That was your slate back then. It was before Avatar and Disney ruined December. Like, December used to be a thing where it was like, hey, it's Christmas. The slightly depressing movies are coming out now. Alongside the movies they're just trying to release before the tax bracket ends, sort of thing.
Right. Yeah, you have the tax write-offs right next to the, we want the Academy to remember this by February.
Exactly. So, yeah, you know, it's, I mean, I'm dying to know, though, what y'all thought. Like, especially you, Darren, with this being your first watch.
Oh, man. Wait a minute. I'm the host of this. You go first, John. That's the way.
Oh, wow. You've turned it around on me in a stunning legal maneuver that I can't. Objection. Objection, counselor.
But I am the judge as well. That's what you didn't see coming.
Drat. I've walked right into it. This is a good movie. I recognize its place in, you know, in history and stuff like that. I recognize as well that Denzel Washington is unfairly overlooked in it. I acknowledge all of these issues that it has, but it is a good film and it's a film worth watching. But feel free to rake me over the coals for it, but on a scale of, five, well, let's just say stars, this is a serious movie where it's like, I don't feel right doing a jokey sort of thing. So yeah. Out of 5 stars, I give this a 4 simply because of the performances. It's really a 3.5. You know, I'm going to revise down, actually. I'm going to go ahead and say 3.5. And it's because the performances are good. But I just, the structure and certain choices just made it very difficult for me to connect to it on an emotional level. And I feel like I needed that emotional connection for this really to be a success. But it is worth watching, and I didn't regret watching it. So 3.5.
I'm giving the same. It's a 3.5 for the exact same reasons that you're talking about. I think the performances alone warrant those amount of stars, but it's just, I have such a problem with Demme's directing in this. It's too in your face. It doesn't fit the tone of the film in a lot of the shots and a lot of the moments. And there's a lot of editing choices that I would have done differently. I think you have a solid script, but you can tell it was hacked up and probably in a few wrong places, which I also think is a director's move. So I think this is the right movie with the right performances, but the wrong director. And so I can't give it 4 or 4.5 or 5 or anything like that, because like when you have a fundamentally flawed picture due to the helmsman, I'm bringing down to 3.5 just because of Hanks and Denzel's performance, which are just phenomenal.
Yeah. I think I'd also give this a 3. It's, you know, like you guys have said, you know, the performances are really good. It was like trying to find who to tell the story about, because it's so odd that obviously Andy he's the main character, but he's not really the main character of the story. And it's like, here's this really interesting character who has an interesting life and what's going to happen. And then we turn around and look at who his lawyer is. And that's who we're going to focus on, their home life, they had a baby. And then there, you know, all of this that's going on. And it's like, maybe it was hampered by it being based on a true story. Maybe we needed a bit of interjection of Hollywood storiness where they both work for the same firm and they've known each other a long time. And maybe, and then Denzel is like, oh, you never told me you were gay. And we were buddies, like, and he's, so not only is he feeling kind of like betrayed or also like, oh my gosh, I've said all these terrible things in front of you, you know, like that, just to give more of a connection between the two, besides I'm the guy on TV and we had a court case once and now I'm this integral part of your life. I don't know. Maybe, like I said, just the difference between based off a true story and actually a Hollywood flex the story a bit to be more interesting or to be more connected between your main two characters.
Could have saved him some lawsuits too.
Yeah, that is true.
That is true.
All right. Well, we're going to continue in the House of Demme one more time in the 90s, talking Beloved from 1998. We're going to see. I don't think any of us have seen this movie, but we're still going through with it as we check it out here on House Lights.
Join the revolution. Join the Nerd Party.